Well, good morning, everyone. I understand that some of you are having trouble doing the radiation safety web class. Is that correct? Have some people succeeded at doing this? So you have to go to, if you're not a Berkeley employee, you have to go to... Okay, apparently if you're not a Berkeley employee, so those of you who actually got some job here apparently could use the normal website, but if you're not working in a lab, apparently you have to go to some slightly external site to take this thing. And I know Melanie is onto this problem, and I'll talk to her again about that because she didn't mention this as a particular solution to me. But if so, then we'll send around another link sometime soon. Now, unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to cover the material on radiation before you take the lab on this class, the rate I'm going at the moment. This is conceptually difficult material, and I've been spending a fair amount of time talking about some, well, not complicated, but conceptually very difficult to accept ideas. So I'm simply not going to get to the right material for the radiation before the lab, which means that you should read the chapters in the appropriate chapters in the book about that. I think radiation is actually a fairly simple subject, at least at the level in which it's done in the class. So I don't think that should be of any problem for you. And if I have to motivate this at all, which I hope I don't, because I think by now I hope you understand that just about everything in physics is absolutely fascinating. But if I have to motivate it, I would tell you who are chemists and biologists that radioactive tagging, positron emission tomography, and subjects like this are incredibly important to the way biology and chemistry are practiced today. Knowing a few simple things about them gets you a very long way to understanding what's actually going on. Any questions then about that? Okay. On a more personal note, next Tuesday in Nature Communications, I have a paper coming out of some importance. Actually, my collaboration has a paper coming out of some importance. I had mentioned at the beginning of the semester that I might spend some time talking about what I do. Unfortunately, that's not going to happen because we're out of time in the class. But if you want to read, get some idea of what we're doing, you can read this paper, which is on antimatter, gravity, and anti-gravity. And I think you'll find at least some of the sections are fairly transparent. There may be a certain amount of publicity about it. I don't know. It's... starting to attract attention from reporters who know about it already. So, let's see. We were discussing last time the idea that the Bohr atom doesn't work, that you have to go over to a new mystical equation called the Schrodinger equation. And the Schrodinger equation is a wave equation. It describes the properties of waves. So, for instance, I can send waves down this wire like that. They zip back and forth and back and forth. And unfortunately, though, it should have been mentioned in 8A, apparently most of you did not see the wave equation, which is, these actually should be partial derivatives, the wave equation, which is the equation that describes waves on this rope, is given by the partial derivative of y, where y is the displacement of the rope, the local displacement. So that if I take this rope and bend it upwards right here, the amount that I bent it upwards will be y, and of course that propagates back and forth along the rope. Anyway, the partial derivative of y, second partial derivative of y with respect to time squared, is equal to the speed of light, I'm sorry, the speed of on this rope, certainly not the speed of light, the speed of the rope on the rope, of waves on the rope squared times the partial derivative of y with respect to the x condition, in this direction along the rope in this case. So this is an equation that tells us the amplitude or the displacement of the rope as a function of space and position. Now, the equations that describe atoms are also wave equations, but there's nothing so simple as the displacement of the rope. There's nothing that we can say that looks like, well, an electron perhaps is displaced upwards like that. That concept doesn't work at all. The thing that's a wave in an atom is given the symbol psi, and it could be a function of position. I'm going to, I'll use x. So it's the Greek symbol phi is the amplitude that we're discussing, and it's a function of position and also time, just like this y is a function of position and time. However, we have to be very careful about this because we don't know what psi is so far. Psi turns out to be probability, and that's a really, really strange concept that you can have a wave for probability. So let me try and explain what I actually mean by that. If I have, going back to this double slit experiment, for instance, if I have a wave, just a light wave, a water wave, whatever, impinging on a double slit, then you know by now that I get some sort of interference pattern which looks something like this. It's got multiple peaks and valleys. Right? And this makes sense from a wave perspective. Now, I showed you that if I consider this problem from a photon or a particle perspective, I showed you a computer simulation last time that had individual photons. So here's a photon, and here's a photon, and here's a photon, and maybe they have some positional spread, who knows. They're all headed towards this slit, and despite the fact that you would think that a photon would either go through one slit or the other, and therefore you'd get sort of an anti-shadow behind one slit and the other. Despite that intuition on our part about how particles behave, that's not actually how particles behave. So what happens is that these interfere just like the light does, and it gives us pile-ups where if we have a piece of film back here and we can measure these individual photons, it gives us pile-ups where these peaks in the interference pattern are. So we get a pile over here, a lot of these hitting the film over here, a lot of them hitting the film over here, a lot of them hitting the film over here, and a lot hitting over here, perhaps more in the center here than on these side lobes, perhaps not. That depends on how we've actually set this up. But none of them hit in the center. So nothing hits right here, or very little hits right here, very little hits right here, here, and so on. Moreover, for any individual photons, I can turn down my light source so that it's only emitting one photon at a time. So there's only one photon at a time in this system. And I can easily record in a thought experiment, which is something we would do just in our head, but these days, it's easy enough to do this with actual experimental apparatus. I can determine where that individual photon wound up. And there's no predictable place where those individual photons wind up. Sometimes they'll wind up here, sometimes there, sometimes here, then back to here, and then maybe down to here. And you saw that in the computer simulation that I was showing. So all we can say about where this photon is going to wind up is that there's some probability that it will wind up in this clump, some probability that it will wind up in this clump, or here, and also some probability that it will wind up in this null space, here, here, or here. The probabilities that it winds up in the null space are relatively small, and is relatively high, large probabilities that it winds up here. And that's all we can say. As surprising as this may be, and as difficult as it may be, to accept. We cannot describe what goes on here deterministically. And this has huge problems for most people, including, frankly, for me, especially when I was first taught this, though I've grudgingly come to accept it. But it's had huge problems to far more sophisticated and smart people like, for instance, Albert Einstein, who never really accepted this, even though he had initiated this field. And the reason for this is that we really, in the end, believe in the philosophical principle of determinism. It's very deeply ingrained on us that if I do something, I get a predictable result. You know, if I throw a ball, it goes someplace. In fact, this has been a religious debate even about free will, for instance. I mean, there are people, philosophers and religious types who have debated whether or not we have any free will at all. Can we do anything that wasn't preordained somehow or other by some superior being? But keeping it down at the level of physics, everything in classical physics that we've talked about is deterministic. You do this, you get that. You do this and you get that same thing again. You do it again and you get exactly the same thing again. And this problem is simply not deterministic. I do not know. I fire a photon in and it winds up over here. I do not know where it's going to wind up in advance. And if I do the same thing to the best of my ability again, it will not wind up necessarily in the same place. There's a remote chance that it might, but chances are it will go someplace else. And if I do it again, replicating my initial conditions as well as I possibly can, it will wind up someplace else. And this isn't a matter of my being a poor experimentalist. It's not a matter that some smarter and better experimentalist than me could get the initial conditions exactly correct, even if I can't. So don't blame me for this problem. This is an intrinsic problem that cannot be gotten around. And that's what the Heisenberg uncertainty principle basically told us, is that we cannot specify initial conditions exactly. We can never know the position and the momentum of something exactly. We can have good knowledge of one, poor knowledge of the other, or poor knowledge of one and good knowledge of the other. Remember, this was this principle that our error in our ability to determine where something was times our error in our ability to determine the momentum of something is always greater than Planck's constant. And you simply cannot get around this. Nor is it the case that the photon has some little internal world inside of it with hidden variables that people are simply too stupid to be able to detect. But if you knew those hidden variables, you would be able to figure out where it's going to go. In fact, this idea of hidden variables was something that physicists took seriously for a very long time. People like Einstein accepted that on the basis of what we knew, we couldn't predict where it was. But he more or less thought that there must be some hidden variables that humans are simply not capable of measuring for some reason or other that would determine where the particle would go. And astonishingly enough, some very, very clever physicists were able to make the following argument. Of course, a hidden variable is hidden to us. The particle is considered some box, and there's something inside that box which we can never know what it is. That's the definition, if you will, of a hidden variable. Okay? But these really clever physicists, the most famous one was perhaps Bell, but there are others that have worked on this problem, said, we're able to come up with a following thought experiment. They said, sure, I'll never know what the hidden variables are, but I can design an experiment such that if there were hidden variables that I could never see, the outcome of that experiment would be different from an experiment in which there were no hidden variables. In other words, we have one box that presumably has hidden variables inside of it that we don't know what they are. We can never see them. Another box that's empty. And they designed an experiment, a thought experiment, that if you did something on these two boxes, the outcomes would be different. I mean, for instance, I throw the box with hidden variables against the wall. It goes splat someplace. And I throw the box with no hidden variables against the wall, and it goes splat someplace else. Note, these hidden variables are still hidden. We don't know what they are, but we do. The idea was that if they existed, it would cause a change in the experiment. And amazingly enough, people actually, in about two decades ago, here in Berkeley primarily, but it spread to other places, were able to do those thought experiments. And so they can prove that these boxes do not have any hidden variables inside of them. The boxes are just empty. There is nothing about the photon, even things that we can't know about, which is a sort of really strange philosophical construct, but there is nothing about this photon, including things that we can't know about, that we don't know about, that determines where these photons wind up. So, where does that leave us? It leaves us with the idea that we absolutely have to have a probabilistic description of what's going on. And this function over here, psi, tells us what that probability is of things happening. More precisely, it's not actually psi that tells us the probability. Psi turns out to be a complex number. Remember complex numbers? 1 plus the square root of minus 1. Square root of minus 1 is an imaginary number. Everybody remembers this stuff intimately, right? Because we're going to do a lot with complex numbers now. Okay, we're not. But you guys remember that there were complex numbers, right? You know, 10 minus 7i. Where I is the square root of minus 1 is a complex number. And complex numbers, because they have an imaginary part, are not something that we can actually measure. A probability is something that we can measure. We know what the probability here. This probability is 1/2 that it shows up in this from here to here, not 1/2 plus the square root of I. I don't even know what a probability that was complex would mean. But psi itself is a complex number. So it turns out that the probability that we talk about is actually the magnitude of psi squared. Remember about complex numbers, they point off in the real plane and then they have some component in the imaginary direction, and that gives them a total length, which is neither real necessarily or purely imaginary, but we can figure out what their length is. It's just like a vector, really, where instead of x and y components of the vector, we have real and imaginary components of the vector. And so this thing that I've written down is just the magnitude squared of the length of that vector, and that turns out to be the probability. So if my vector is not this nor that, but is, say, pointing like this, the magnitude of the vector is just this length. Okay? And I'd like to show you some examples of this. I have another computer simulation to show you, if I could get this up on the screen over there. And I'm going to see if I can, without unplugging any of this stuff, come to the other side so I can actually see it too as I run this. So what I'm going to do is to launch a particle from one side of this apparatus to the other side of the apparatus. So here we go. Here it goes. There's a particle. Now, there's lots of things to look at in this diagram, so I'll go through this a little bit slowly. So the first thing is the top axis. And this is the potential in which this particle is running. At the moment, that's totally flat. It's totally flat. That means that I'm doing the equivalent of rolling a particle along a flat floor. Okay? Later on, we'll do some... Why did this thing go around in a circle rather than going straight? It's slightly pyramidal. The radius over here is bigger than the radius over here. But you could visualize. We're doing thought experiments now. So visualize a completely round chalk and my rolling it along the floor and it goes in a straight line. Okay. So the top graph there is the potential, which is completely boring at the moment. It's just flat. The bottom graph is what I'd like to concentrate on at the moment. And we're going to be trying to launch a kind of discrete particle representative of an electron. So what does that mean? When we start out, we have some sense of where the electron is. So we have, but not a perfect sense. Remember that Heisenberg's uncertainty principle says basically we're never going to know exactly where it is, at least if we want to have some idea of where it's, what its momentum is. And we have some idea of how fast it's moving, but Heisenberg's uncertainty principle doesn't allow us to know exactly how fast it's moving. So if I launch this again, what you'll see is that the probability of finding that particle, let me do that again, starts out well localized, right? It's somewhere from here to here, and then it moves along. But because we have uncertainty in the momentum as it moves along, we don't know quite how fast it's going. So it's not as if this clump moves from here and then has the same shape over here, right? Because we didn't know how fast it's going. We know how fast it's going on the average, so maybe we know where the center of this clump is going, but it could have been moving faster than we think that average is, or slower. So by the time it gets over to here, it will have spread out because we just don't know where it was. And you can see that in the simulation. Watch it again as it goes across. Where's my laser pointer? But as it goes apart, it spreads out. And you'll also see that its amplitude diminishes, right? Why does its amplitude diminish? We have to have a probability of 1 of finding that electron. The electron doesn't suddenly disappear, right? So it spread out in size like this. It was narrow, well localized, and then it spread out in size like this, which means we can find it over some wider range. But at the maximum, in the center, its probability has to go down as it propagates along because it's spread out over a wider region. Everybody see that? And you can see that. I'll run it one more time. So now, this time study, just watch what it does. The peak is sharp initially, and then it spreads out. There it goes. And it's spreading out and its amplitude is going down. Its amplitude is going down so much that by the, I mean, I'm still tracking perhaps where the center is. By this point, it's really spread out and its amplitude has gone down in any one position to almost zero. Nonetheless, if you took a picture and then took a snapshot and integrated where you would find the electron, you would have to get a total probability of 1 of finding that electron somewhere, right? Okay, so what else? What about the middle graph? Well, the middle graph is, and I'm not going to tell you, I'll get to it in a little bit more detail, but the middle graph is this, not this probability itself, but the wave function, psi. Okay? And you'll see that it's an oscillatory thing. It kind of looks like one of these things, right? I snap the rope, and a pulse propagates across the room. So I snap the system, if you will, by putting in an electron, and you see a pulse which propagates across the room. It spreads out because we don't know what its velocity, its momentum is, and it goes down in amplitude, but it moves across like a wave that's going across the room. Now, some of you may be wondering about the fact that the probability seems to go to zero in some places, right? Sometimes it's positive, sometimes it's negative, this wave function, and sometimes it's zero. Well, remember, first of all, we don't have negative probabilities because we're always taking the magnitude, and the magnitude gets rid of negative probabilities. It squares it. But it still goes through zero. So how can it go through zero? Well, the answer to that question is that I'm only in this graph actually plotting the real part of psi. Remember, psi is actually an imaginary quantity. And I can plot both the real and the imaginary part. It makes the graph a little bit more complicated. But now you can see that there are two waveforms plugging along. The blue one is the imaginary part. The red one is the real part. And there's, if you add them together, well, if you find their magnitude according to this function, you can see wherever this one is zero, wherever the imaginary part is zero, the real part is not zero, which is why when we look at the bottom axis, which gives us the probability, it doesn't have any strange nulls. In this case, there are other cases where it will have some strange nulls, but in this case, it doesn't. Okay, I've been doing talking nonstop. This is a difficult conceptual problem. Are there any questions about this? If you're not mystified, you're not paying attention. So questions are really okay. Yes? The wave function is a solution to Schrodinger's equation, which I have not yet written down. But I will write down Schrodinger's equation, and then you'll see why I've been avoiding writing it down. But what it means, which is the important thing, is that when I take its amplitude squared, that gives me the local probability of finding the particle at that some instant in time and space. Okay? So that's actually going to be my next step, is to write down Schrodinger's equation. Yeah. Well, this particle could go splat along a screen. So I would get, if I was to plot psi squared in this example, would be this function. Okay? But what I'm modeling up there is just the very simple act of firing an electron on a flat potential, which is a somewhat different problem. Yes? Yes, it would be. And you'll see why in a few minutes why I'm really avoiding writing that down. Yes? Shows that we don't know where it is, or we what? All of the above. Planck's constant. You'll see in a few minutes that this wave function not only gives us the position, but it also gives us the momentum of the particle. And since the momentum is a function of the wave function, and that momentum is spread out, I'm sorry, the wave function is spread out, the momentum is going to be similarly spread out. Other questions about this? Okay. Well, I think at this point I can't avoid writing down what the Schrodinger's equation is. So let me do that. I'm going to write down Schrodinger's equation in one dimension. There was just a question about how many there is. So I'm only going to write it down as a function of x. And it's equal to minus h bar squared divided by twice the mass of whatever particle is that we're trying to look at. And then the derivative, actually the second derivative squared of this wave function x of t, and then plus another function, which is the potential, and I'm going to assume a time-independent potential. In other words, the ground is not shaking, we're not having an earthquake, everything's static, times the wave function. And that's equal to the energy of the particle times this very same wave function. So this is the potential energy. So this maybe has a graph that might look something like this. I don't know. It depends on what it is. But just think of this as a ball rolling in this potential energy, if you will. So this is U of x. And this is the total energy. That this particle has. Now, this is similar to the wave equation on a string, but it's got some differences. This wave equation has derivatives only in x. I'm sorry, this one only has derivatives in x, while this has derivatives in x and in t, but it describes a wave, as I can show you in a few minutes. This is not something I can derive. This is life. This is just what nature, God, whatever you wish, has given us. So I can't derive it. I can't tell you how I got there. It just works. But I can maybe kind of justify it to you in a way that will bring back a question that I had a few minutes ago. It turns out that if I want to know the momentum of a particle as a function of x and t, that the momentum of this particle turns out to be equal to minus h bar squared divided by 2m times the derivative of psi with respect to time. Well, the second derivative with respect to space, excuse me, not time. In other words, the momentum is squared, to be more precise. The momentum squared is equal to this term. And so you can see that the momentum is also a function of this wave function. And to answer the question that was back there, since the wave function is spread out, the momentum is going to have some corresponding spread. Now, if you accept this, and there's really no reason to, except that I stated it's correct, but if you accept this, then then you can kind of see maybe where this came from, because then I could rewrite the momentum equation. I could rewrite this excuse me. I could rewrite the Schrodinger's equation as p squared what have I done? Apologize. There's no 2m here. It's just minus Planck's constant squared times the second derivative of phi. And technically speaking, and this won't make any sense to most of you, technically speaking, that p is an operator, not a number. And let's just not worry about that. I could rewrite this then as p squared divided by 2m plus u of x. And I'm going to pull out this x of t. So this p is sort of like that minus 8 squared times the second derivative with respect to x, but no argument. I pulled the argument out. And then that's equal to the energy times x of t, not x of t, psi of t. And you can see at some level, and I don't want to take this too seriously, this is common to both sides. So I could rewrite this as p squared divided by 2m plus u, potential energy, is equal to E. But of course, P is equal to M times V. So this could be rewritten, crudely speaking, as M squared times V squared divided by 2 times M plus U X is equal to E. And this can be rewritten as 1 half M V squared plus U of X, V, I guess, is a function of x now, too, is equal to E. And what equation is that? That's just conservation of energy, isn't it? I have the kinetic energy plus the potential energy is equal to the total energy. So I don't know if this helps you to accept that there's some reality to the Schrodinger's equation or not, but it can be reduced to things that we're familiar to before if we're willing to do all of these simplifications. So where do we go from here? This equation is difficult to solve. Not horribly difficult to solve, but nonetheless difficult to solve. And I've given it to you as the one-dimensional version. It was mentioned a few minutes ago that I really should do this as the three-dimensional version. So I'm going to write down the three-dimensional version of this equation, which, if I was a better physicist, I would have memorized, but I don't. So it's minus h-bar squared divided by 2m. Well, let me take a side note. I'm going to write this down in what's called spherical coordinates. A hydrogen atom is basically a sphere. So I want to use spherical coordinates. What are spherical coordinates? Well, this is a challenge for me. But if this is x, y, and z, x, y, and z are not good coordinates to talk about a hydrogen atom in because x and y, they have no sense of this, the fact that it's basically a sphere. What I'd really like to talk about is that if I have some point which is, say, out here in space. This point can be represented by a position r, like that, an angle from the vertical, and the angle from the vertical will be equal to, it's going to be equal to phi, like that. And then if I project down onto this axis over here, there's this angle, which I'm going to call theta. So if I want to locate a point relative to a spherical origin, I need to know how far away it is from that origin, what the angle is from being straight up, and how much it's rotated around. Okay? And you can immediately see this isn't going to be fun at all. Okay. So with that in mind, Schrodinger's equation becomes 1 over r squared times the derivative of psi with respect to r. Now, these are going to be partial derivatives now because this function is really very much a function of several different coordinates, so I'll write this down. But it's not even that simple. It's not the partial derivative of this function with respect to r. It's a partial derivative of r squared times d by dr of psi. Now, this is going to be r, theta, phi, and t. Okay, are we done? No, we are not done. Plus 1 over r squared times the sine of theta times d by d theta of sine of theta d by d theta again of psi r comma theta comma phi comma t. Are we done? Plus 1 over r squared sine squared theta d squared psi of r theta phi and t with respect to phi. Do you think we're done now? Plus the potential, which is a function of r phi, I've been writing them in the opposite order, r theta phi, and now I'll allow it to be time dependent, times psi of r theta a t, r theta phi of t. What about now? No, this has to be equal to something. So what is it going to be equal to? It should be equal to this term over here, except that it's not. It's equal to the square root of minus 1, I told you complex numbers are going to haunt us, times h bar times the derivative, the singular derivative, not the second derivative of psi r theta phi t with respect to time. And are we done now? Yeah, we're done. Okay. If you think that equation is hard to solve, we can try this one. Yes. Well, the energy is equal to, just like the momentum was equal to minus h squared, the energy is equal to I h bar d psi dt. That's the total energy in the system. But now it turns out that if the system is changing, if you are in a room with an earthquake, the total energy can change. If I have something down on the ground like that and there are no earthquakes, its total energy doesn't change, right? But if there is an earthquake, if the potential is changing, it can change. And so this energy now, I should have written it, the total energy is now a function of time. And also, so it's a little messy, but yeah, something like that, okay? These are operators, and I don't really want to get into the difference between what a function is and what an operator is. Okay. So now, where am I? I'm here. So we now have a choice. We would like, anybody see my laser pointer? Yes, right here. We could solve this equation. And believe it or not, people have solved this equation. Because this equation, at least for the hydrogen atom, is so important that basically what happened is that people invented functions that solve these things. I mean, why do we have sine functions? Can anybody tell me why we have sines and cosines? So we can measure triangles. So there are other functions called spherical harmonics which solve this equation, and they were invented to solve this equation because it's such an important equation. So we could solve this, and we could do the hydrogen atom and the helium atom and all of these atoms. Or I could solve some simplified trivial trite problems using this equation, which aren't hydrogen atoms, but will bring out most of the important concepts about solving for the hydrogen atom. So we'll take a vote. How many people want me to do this equation? Okay, a few. How many people want me to do this equation? you don't have a choice. I'm doing one or the other, so you might as well vote. So how many people want this equation? Most of you. And this one? A few people. Well, unfortunately, I think I have to go back to graduate school to teach this one because I've mostly forgotten this solution. So we're stuck. We're going to be doing that equation over there. All right. So the first problem that one solves, the first problem that one solves using that equation over there is called the particle in a box problem. And really, it's an absurd approximation to the real world, but it actually works for certain things. Like it works for, it's a very good model of atomic nuclei. It's a good model of what are called color centers. If you chemists out there, and some of you, have, has anybody ever heard of a color center? Not yet, but color centers are what gives certain dyes their particular color. And so this model that I'm going to show you, particle in a box, is a good model of those things. So what is the model? Basically, the model is that we have a box. What does a box look like? A box looks like a potential, and the particle is rattling around somewhere in the bottom of this potential. But outside, the potential is so high, it's infinite, that the particle can't possibly go there. So we represent that by drawing a graph of the potential as a function of x, and these arrows represent the fact that it's infinity, going to infinity here and here, and also any place outside of the box. So just think of this really as a shoebox in which I'm going to put a particle. The particle cannot penetrate the sides of the shoebox. It can't go outside. Okay? So this is the problem that we're going to solve. And how do we go about doing it? Well, let me rewrite the one-dimensional Schrodinger's equation. Minus h bar squared divided by 2m times the second derivative of psi, which is now only a function of this position x, plus the potential as a function of x times psi of x is equal to e times psi. Now, I also should put in some boundary. Let's say, specify how big the box is. Let's say this side is at x equals 0, and this side is at x is equal to L. All right? Well, there are really two regions where we could solve this equation. One region is inside the box, where the potential is flat, 0, boring, and one region outside the box where the potential is infinite, maybe more complicated, but the particles never go there. So we really don't have to worry about the solution of this equation outside of the box. We only have to worry about it inside the box. And that allows us to just remove this term altogether, because inside the box for x between 0 and L, that potential function is equal to 0. So I can rewrite this as minus h squared bar squared over 2m times the second derivative of psi with respect to x squared is equal to the total energy times psi. And now we're starting to get something that looks a little bit simpler. So I'm going to rewrite that slightly just by rearranging terms. Psi squared d by dx squared is equal to minus 2me divided by h bar squared times the potential psi. Okay? And now we're going to take a little bit of a pause, because it turns out that this week I'm in a medical study and I have to take a pill at noon. So I'll have you know that these pills' side effects include giddiness. They're hallucinogenic. And they also cause lack of sleep. So I only got 4.5 hours of sleep last night. So if this lecture has been any more incoherent than normal, that may be an explanation. On the other hand, some of you may be interested in things that cause hallucinogens. And, you know, for a certain price, never mind. Okay. So let's go back to this equation. They also taste foul, by the way. So trying to solve this equation over here, this really isn't a complicated equation to solve. It's just the second derivative of something is equal to some constant times that something. So what when I take its second derivative gives that thing, same thing back with a minus sign? Sines and cosines do. So the solution of this equation is just equal to psi, and it's only a function of x now because we're not worrying about any time dependence here. Psi of x is going to be equal to some amplitude A, which is unspecified, times either a sine or a cosine. But I'm just going to write down sines. And then whatever I have, I need to take the square root of this 2me divided by h bar squared, and then times the position x. So why does this work? I take the second derivative of sine, I get the minus sign that's required here, and I also bring out two factors of this. You know, first the sine turns into a cosine, then it turns back into a sine, but each time I do it, I bring out one factor of this thing in the square root, and when I do that, well, to bring out two square identical square roots, and I get this thing over here. So this is the solution here. A, I don't know. It's a constant of integration, as they say. Did you have a question? Okay, so that's actually a good question, because it brings out why this is a wave equation, but not the wave equation that you have been brought up on. Okay, the wave equation that you're brought up on is a wave equation for an amplitude. I snap the rope, and I have an amplitude, a y, if you will. This is an equation. There is no y in this equation. What there is a probability amplitude in this equation. Okay? So there's no y coordinate here. There's only a coordinate along the box. And I'm assuming that this is a one-dimensional box, unless you want me to solve that equation. Okay? So there's no y here, just x. And this psi, when I square it anyway, will give me the probability amplitude. So what do we do now? Well, let's draw some solutions that this equation might give. So, solutions. Here's my well. It's an infinitely deep well or box like that. And I'm going to draw some possible psis. So here's going to be psi as a function of position. And at x is equal to 0, which is the left-hand side of the box, what's the sine of 0? 0. So I might get a solution that looks like that. Or perhaps, I don't know, I could get a solution that looks like this. There's lots of sine waves that fit inside this box, right? Well, actually not right. I misspoke just there. There are lots of sine waves that I could put inside this box. But what I just said is that there are lots of sine waves that fit inside that box. And that's not true. There aren't lots of sine waves that fit inside the box. Remember, when I take this rope and oscillate it up and down, What's the amplitude at both ends, precisely at both ends? Zero. And that's true even if I excite a higher order mode. Well, if I do it well, it's still zero. Here's another mode in there. Still zero at the ends, it's zero in the center too. The same thing is going to be true here. I have to get this to fit inside the box. And why is that? Because I know that the amplitude of the probability of finding a particle outside the box, here, beyond the walls of the box, is equal to zero on both sides. And it doesn't make any sense that the ball could be just inside the box and have a large amplitude, and just outside the box and have zero amplitude. The probability of finding the particle cannot take a jump like this. It's got to move smoothly. It could have a kink, perhaps. It has a kink over here. See, it comes in and then its slope changes. That's a kink. Kinks are okay. But a jump like this is not okay. So whatever this probability amplitude does, psi, it has to fit inside the box with an even number of wavelengths, or more precisely, an even number of half wavelengths. So what does that tell us? That tells us, if we have a sine wave, what does the argument of a sine wave have to be to get zero when we take the argument of that, the sine of that argument? What are possible values? Zero is one of them. The sine of zero is zero. But what other things gives us zero when we take the sine of them? Integer multiples of pi. So we know that from the condition that the sine of n times pi is equal to zero, where n is 1, 2, 3, 4. Zero is also true. N equals zero, but that's completely boring if I took zero there. That I know that if I insist that n pi is equal to 2me divided by h bar squared times l, I should say, or more precisely, that I insist that this times l is equal to n pi, I know that I'll be taking the sine of some integer multiple of pi. And the sine of an integer multiple of pi is zero. So my wave function will not do what this one did. It will go straight to zero over here. Well, this leads to a condition. Let me rewrite it. N squared pi squared is divided by L squared is equal to 2me divided by h bar squared. Now, n is an integer that we select, but it's an integer. Pi is a constant. L is the size of our shoebox. We're given a shoebox, so it can't change. 2 is a constant. M, for the particle that we put inside a box, is also a constant. And h bar is a constant. So if we're going to make this equality work, what's the only thing that we can vary to make sure that this condition occurs? N is varying. N is sometimes 1, sometimes 2, and sometimes 3. What else can we vary? E, we can vary the energy. If we insist, first of all, let's give it a label. If we insist that the energy is equal to n squared pi squared h bar squared divided by 2ml. Did I do that right? L squared. If we insist that this condition is met, then the sine of this thing will be zero here. That happened automatically because x was equal to zero. But also over here, because when we plug in that value of the energy into this expression over here, and I'll put in e sub n to remind us that there are only some allowed n's here, when we plug that in and plug in x is equal to l, then this will be equal to some integer multiple of pi. So we will have met this condition. Now this can be simplified because if you remember, h bar is equal to h, Planck's constant, divided by 2 pi. So I can simplify this and rewrite it as pi is going to cancel. I'm going to rewrite this as h squared divided by 8 times m times l squared times n squared is what these energy levels are. So what have we concluded? If I put a particle into a box, it is not free to take any energy it pleases. It has to take an energy which is quantized according to that formula over there. So now you see maybe the genius of Niels Bohr, who introduced quantization of energy levels in a way that was fairly similar. He said that waveforms had to fit inside a hydrogen atom. Well, I'm saying that once again, that my probability waveform has to fit inside of my square box. This is the origin of quantization in a square box, but it will also hold if I was so bold as to try and solve this equation for a hydrogen atom. And when I do this, I get a series of energy levels, if you will. So what do those energy levels look like? So here's my box. Okay, and inside of my box, I'm going to have some waveforms. The simplest waveform for psi that I could have is that waveform. Here's the bottom of my box, like that. The first thing I'm going to do is to write the energy level. I'm going to indicate the energy level. Here's the bottom of the box. Can I have a particle that sits on the bottom of the box with no energy? Yes or no? No, I cannot, because I have to have n is equal to 1. That's the lowest I can have. And n equals 1 gives me some energy, which might be represented by that line over here in an energy diagram. So this is the potential energy is the box that I drew, but this line that I drew over here is an energy level. This is the n equals 1 state of the particle in the box, and in some units or other, we'll give it an energy of 1. Now, next I'm going to draw what the wave function, the probability wave function is. And I'll use this, for reasons that you'll see are convenient, I'll use this as the center, the zero, of that probability wave function. And so that will look something like that, just a simple sine wave. It goes to zero right here. Zero right here has some amplitude in the middle. So that's the lowest order state. And then I have another state. Where's the next state going to be? The next state will be n is equal to 2. What will be the energy of the n equals 2 state relative to the n equals 1 state? What is it going to be? It's going to be 4 times as large, because it goes like n squared. So it was n equals 1 squared, that's 1. N equals 2 squared is 4. So it will be somewhere up here will be the energy of this next state. So this has an energy of 4, n equals 2 state, and its wave function. Anybody willing to guess what the wave function is going to look like? Yes, one full wavelength, which means what? One node, thank you. One node in the center. So the probability waveform is going to look like that. Remember, this is psi. To find the actual probability, I have to square this. The next one is going to be n equals 3. That's going to be about here, because the energy of the n equals 3 is going to be what? It's going to be 9. So it's going to be somewhere up here. And that waveform is going to have how many nodes in the center? It's going to have two nodes in the center. So it's going to look something like this. So these are the allowed waveforms that I can have. Now, I've drawn the waveforms themselves. The probabilities look a little bit different than that, because the probabilities, which I'm... Let me actually label these explicitly. This is psi. This is psi. And this is psi. The probabilities are the squares of these waveforms. And the squares of these waveforms look like this. Okay, that's the square, psi squared, for the lowest waveform. Psi squared for this waveform looks like this. Oh, those were supposed to be the same height. So this is psi squared. I'll call this psi 1 squared, and this is psi 2 squared, and psi 3 squared. Psi 3 squared. Looks like that. So immediately we come to a rather amazing, little fascinating conclusion that if a particle is in the lowest energy state inside of a box, where am I going to likely to find it? Is it I'm going to find it likely to be equally likely to be everywhere in the box? No, where am I going to find the particle most likely? Somewhere where the probability amplitude is the largest, the waveform squared is the largest, and where is that? Everybody wake up. Where is that? It's in the center. Now, if it's in the n equals 2 state, am I likely to find the particle in the center? No, actually, it's not going to be in the center at all. It's more likely displaced off to the sides a little bit. And in the n equals 3 state, is it going to be in the center? Perhaps, but there are two places off to the side where it is not. And once again, because this is a confusing point, this question was brought up, the fact that this goes negative here does not mean that the probability is negative here. I don't know what a negative probability is. The probabilities come from squaring it, which is a positive definite quantity. Another thing is, some of you may be wondering what happened to this amplitude A. I'm not interested in the amplitude A in any great detail, but you adjust the amplitude A so that the total integrated probability from here to here along any one of these curves is equal to 1. We have to find the particle in the box. So we just adjust A to scale this up and down so that when we integrate that probability, we get 1. That's a mathematically sometimes a little bit nasty, but it's simple enough. Okay. So let's talk about another thing. From this diagram, we can make an energy level diagram. What do I mean by that? Well, here's the n equals 1 state. Let me just redo this. This is n equals 1 with an energy of 1. Here's n equals 2 with an energy of 2. And here's n equals 3 with an energy of 9. Now, what else did Bohr say, which turns out to be very insightful? He said that there are energy states inside of his atoms, and the way the atom radiates is to make a jump, a discrete jump between one energy state and the next energy state. You can't wind up with an energy that's anywhere in between, so you have to make a jump. And this diagram tells us what the jumps are. For instance, who could tell me what the lowest energy jump in this? This should be a 4. Thank you. Can anybody tell me what the lowest energy jump is going to be? It's going to be 2 to 1. If we make a jump from here to here, that's going to be the jump. And how much energy do we get? What's the delta E for this? We went from 2. So how much energy is in this jump? It's 3. So delta E is equal to 3. But that's not the only jump we could make. We could go from the n equals 3 state to the n equals 2 state, right? How much energy is in this jump? So this state is going to have an energy of 5, but we could also do this, right? How much energy is in this one? 8. And if I put in another state, which is not going to be properly spaced, but the n equals 4 state, that's going to have 16 up here. And that would mean that I could make this jump, which is going to have an energy of 7, change in energy of 7. I could make this jump, which is going to have an energy change of 12. And I could make this jump, which has an energy change of 15. So you're starting to see, I hope, something else that Bohr predicted, which sort of looks like the Rydberg atom. These things come in groups. Remember we said there was one group? I showed you the spectrum of a hydrogen atom. There was one group that was visible. There was one group that was ultraviolet. There was another group that was in, well, actually many other groups that were in the infrared. We're getting groups here too. So each of these lines corresponds to a line on a spectrum. So if I had a spectrum table, so here's a spectral table, some colors appearing if I was to look at the spectrum of this. So this spectrum is going to be lambda. And lambda, of course, is inverse in energy. So this will have the largest wavelength. So I'm going to get reddish-type colors over here. And there's only one of those reddish colors in this drawing. Then I'm going to have two greenish colors, which are reasonably close together. This one would correspond to 5, and this one would correspond to 8. And then I'm going to have a clumping of these guys, where this corresponds to 7, except that it gets a little mixed up, because 8 is less than 7. So here's a 7, and then I'm going to have a 12 and a 15. So that would be the spectrum of this square wave potential when I'm all done. So, what are we going to do from here? I've taken what may seem to be an artificial problem, namely a particle in a square well box, all right? But we took this problem because it's something that we can solve fairly easily. That wasn't so hard, was it? Okay, slightly hard. But not so hard. We can solve this problem of particles in the box. And what does it tell us? It tells us a couple of key features, which are the key features that Bohr, with his atom, came up with. He came up with the idea that the energy levels in a Bohr atom, which is an improper thing, just a coincidence, but he said the energy levels are quantized, right? And we got quantized energy levels out of this. And he said that we could make transitions, spectra, that were jumps between those quantized levels. And that comes out of this too, because we can only jump from one level to the next level. I can't have a spectral line that goes from here to, say, over here, right? Because there's no energy level for it to wind up at right over here. It can't happen. It's got to make a full jump. and only some variable, some full jumps are allowed. So we'll get spectral lines, like these spectral lines over here, at discrete places, sharp spectra. And we also tend to get clumping, though in this example, the clumping is a little bit mixed up with each other. There's other ways I could have set this up so that they would be less mixed up with each other. And this is how we do all problems. These features are going to show up every single time we try and solve something using Schrodinger's equation. What we're going to do is we're going to take the equation, whether we use the one-dimensional version or the three-dimensional version. We're going to solve for possible solutions of Schrodinger's equation, like this solution over here. And then we're going to say, well, there has to be some quantization because of boundary conditions. What forced this wave to be incorrect, this red wave up here? A boundary condition, because we can't have a sharp jump. We've got to go to zero at this boundary. Other boundary conditions can be more complicated. It doesn't always go to zero. But in this case, it has to go to zero. And those boundary conditions force us to quantize things, to give us certain energy levels. In this case, it was really simple, because we just had to force the sine wave to go to zero. That's what gives us these things. So this is a general prescription for solving even this extraordinarily messy equation. But the ideas, which are the important ideas, much more important than actually being able to solve it at the level that we're discussing this, remain the same. You solve the equation, you get some function or another. That function needs to be quantized. The quantization gives you discrete energy levels, and that gives you discrete spectrum. And I think I'll close a minute early today. See you guys on Tuesday.